Hold everything. So, you're telling me that we're listening to the best podcast in the world?
That's right, Daffy.
Yes, and it's called the Movie Rob Minute Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 115 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me on this lovely Friday is Mark Hoffmeyer of Movies, Films, and Flicks, and also from the Deep Blue Sea Pod and the Con Air Pod. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Hey, to get into character for this episode, I went to Atlanta. I found the tallest building, got to the top of it. I'm in the sundial right now, and I'm just ready to record. I'm at the top of the building. I'm going to record this final episode with you and I. We've done five, but yeah, it's going to be...
We've done four. Right, this is the fifth. Hanging this out. Is the fifth. There you go.
Yeah, this is the fifth episode. So I'm the final episode that we're doing together, I went to the tallest building in Atlanta just to get into character for this. I'm not going to get shot like Ken Lee, Al Young here, but, you know, fingers all right, crossed.
Just get down, get the f*** downstairs. That's what you have to do.
Run!
That's right. He doesn't even say run. Okay, so minute 115 begins with the Huey coming in for the final approach and ends with the Huey aiming for the building. So the first thing I have to say about this entire minute, I know that I like to go in order and stuff like that, but the shots here are just unbelievable. You know, we talked earlier this week about the Huey shots and the fact that, you know, they had to, you know, they only had the Hueys for a certain number of hours and stuff like that. But it's just amazing, some of these shots. You know, they've got amazing aerial shots here. You know, Jan de Bont did an amazing job. If he's the one who... you know, did the shots, which I'm assuming he did. You know, this isn't the type of thing that you'd hand off to somebody else, I don't think.
No, I mean, like, even if you're, because this was so important, you don't just give it to a second unit director. You know, like, second unit directors are great. You know, David R. Ellis, who did Deep Blue Sea, went on to direct Snakes on a Plane and Shark Night. But it's, yeah, I think Jan de Bont was in this. They, because they didn't have that much time, so they had to plan the heck out of it. And I think this is a case of them, you know, they didn't have much time, but they planned it so well that they got the footage they needed. And we were talking about this too, like, nothing beats the fact that these are real helicopters flying around this city. There's some green screen work, sure, but for the most part, the footage they got is practical, and that's why it doesn't age, and that's why it looks great. Like, this, you can't beat that. Like, I keep saying this, but, like, you know, my favorite action films, kind of like what Predator, they're like in the middle of it. Like, Mad Max Fury Road, they're in Tunisia in the middle of nowhere. Like, I love action films that, like, go on location. And this movie, I mean, it was shot in LA, but they still, like, everything was in camera. And that's why it looks so beautiful. I love it. It doesn't get old.
Right. And this is also, you could say that this is, they went on location in LA to do it.
Yeah, know, exactly.
You know, this isn't a film that they just did the entire thing on a soundstage. You know, that type of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Yeah, Michael Mann would be proud of the on location work.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, it starts off with a whole bunch of shots of the local LA skyline, you know, as the Hueys get closer. And, you know, these aerial shots are just unbelievable. And they even show us the Nakatomi helipad from the side and stuff like that. And it's just great because you can follow these helicopters as they're going through. You know, they pass that fountain that we talked about earlier this week. And, you know, we even get a far shot where you can see the fountain in the distance. It's just great. You know, everything is lit up really well and stuff like that. And then, you know, the Hueys come in for an approach, you know, towards the Nakatomi itself. And then we get a shot of our one of the few thieves slash terrorists still alive, Al Leong, you know, Uli. And he's standing on the top of the steps, guiding people along, which, again, it once again brings up the question to me. Okay, you have, let's say, 30 hostages, and you have one terrorist standing there, you know, herding them forward, you know, and stuff like that. So
I mean, it may. Oh, sorry, go for it.
No one tries. No, nobody tries to stop him. No one tries to just like push him over the side. I don't know. You know, you can try and do something. It's the fear. You know, of I guess that's why it's called terrorism. You know, you're afraid. they're instilling terror in you, as the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, they're rushing him upstairs. They're getting him going. Gruber just fired shots into the air. Everyone's a little disoriented, running upstairs. You probably have tunnel vision. So I mean, I couldn't say what I would do. So I was kind of. We did talk about how it was kind of interesting. We thought Uli would stay behind them and kind of get them all upstairs.
But at one point and then he like moved past them, you know, like he's moving back and forth. He's moving up and down the line, you know, getting people moving.
I'm just not messing with this guy though.
Right. He'd be a good drill sergeant. You know, imagine Arlie Ermey doing this, you know, running back and forth, screaming at them, you know, screaming at them to get moving because they've eaten too many donuts or something like that. I don't know.
He'd be a good fitness instructor. CrossFit. Now, Carl Jung's CrossFit gym. I'd work it. I'd go to his stunt school. I was watching all of his death scenes earlier on Al Young death reel, and he does a good shoot and jump backwards. I gotta tell you, like he's the king at getting air after getting shot. It's so lovely how he gets shot.
Okay, I'm assuming they do this with the harness, right?
Oh no, not like when you just gotta jump on a table. You know, in some movies, if let's say you have a shotgun and you blow somebody away 14 feet. Then, yeah, you probably put him on a harness and you pull it. But a lot of these that I was watching, he just gets shot and goes off his feet and falls on like a table. You don't even know. There's no way to even see the wire.
And breaks the table?
He just landed on it and fell off of it. Like, it's a pretty good work. He even got I do love it. In Last Action Hero, he gets a ice cream cone in the back of his head, which is pretty lovely. And our friends at Exploding Helicopter will love the scene from Escape from L.A. and Hard Hunted, where he's in a helicopter that blows up. He's had a lot of good deaths, and he was Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. In Bill and Ted, of course. I mentioned this earlier in the season. I remember when I was watching the first season of 24, you know, which came out, what was it, 10 or 12 years after this movie? Or no, it came out, that was in 2001, I believe. So there's 13 years after this movie, and then I saw him, and he had, like, gained weight, but he was still Angerman. You know, and you can still notice that it's Al Young, you know, same guy.
The hair, you know, like, and he's in everything. The guy is in everything. Like, so many movies. And I know we're talking, he gets shot in this scene, but can I break down my five favorite Al Young deaths?
Of course you can.
All right.
That's why I have you here, Mark. Give top fives of things that people would never think to even, you know, make a top five about. And that's what Mark's for. Mark will make a top five. You know, you can have like top five, I don't know, top five Cheeto people running around in their underwear, you know, after being shot at or something, some crazy things like that, you know.
Underwear scenes. Probably got to get Jean-Claude Van Damme in there. Yep. And It Follows would go. Negligee wear. All right, no. So my number five is Last Action Hero. He gets stabbed in the back of the head with an ice cream cone while in a car chase with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And then he says, doesn't he say, like, keep killing or something like that?
Yeah, something stupid that Arnold says. I mean, clearly stupid on purpose. But he gets the ice cream cone in the back of his head, and it's just absolutely lovely. And then I'm going to say I got to add a Dolph Lundgren death because he's been in Dark Angel with them. He's been in this, but I'm going to say Showdown in Little Tokyo. So he's either shot by Brandon Lee or Dolph Lundgren, but he does a great shoot and fall. That makes me really happy. And Hard Hunted, if you type in Hard Hunted in like Google and look at the pictures of this movie, it's insane. But a rocket launcher blows him up. He gets blown up by a rocket launcher when he's in a helicopter. And that's just lovely. Like, I love that when that happens. You got to do that. Then I'll do number 8. You know what? I'll put Die Hard in here because it's just, you know, he's one of the last guys remaining. And he doesn't even put up a fight. He just opens up the door and gets shot. But last but not least, the best one is Lethal Weapon. When
Gibson
wraps his legs around his neck. And and then he strangles Mel Gibson, strangles him with his owl. Al's name is his name. Mel Gibson was strangling him with his legs. Like he takes him out, snaps his neck when Al was torturing him. But he's really featured in that. And it's a unique death because you never really get much like neck snap strangled via legs death. So correct. I'm taking Lethal Weapon number one.
Okay, now here's a question. I think I discussed this with someone else earlier in the season. Do you think that Die Hard and Lethal Weapon take place in the same universe?
Die Hard, okay, that's interesting. I mean, they both take place on the West Coast. I don't think there's too much. I mean, that means so that was 87 and Die Hard was 88?
Yeah.
No, but that means did Al have a twin brother? Does Al have clones?
That's my question. He's also in Lethal
Weapon 4.
That's my question here.
So he's in Lethal Weapon 4, Die Hard, and Lethal Weapon.
So
let's say yeah.
Well, actually, if he's in Lethal Weapon 4 and Lethal Weapon, that means there's already, you know, brothers there. You know, so the question is there? That's right. Well, identical triplets.
Does that happen?
Sure, why not?
I mean, exactly alike. I want to believe that. I want to believe there's an ALCU. No, an ACU, an Al Cinematic Universe.
Well, it doesn't have to be an Al Cinematic Universe, you know. But
yeah, I mean, all the movies combined. Like, let's say Big Trouble in Little China actually happened too. That's on the West Coast as well.
At that point, you're already talking about clones. You're not even talking about, you know, triplets or quadruplets or septuplets or whatever it is. I mean, this is, you know, when you reach a certain point where they can't just be, you know, twins or, you know, identical twins. It you know, then you're getting into the cloning area, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. You know, I'm okay with the fact that he's possibly a, you know, that they've cloned him.
And you know what else I love? He gets killed in Big Trouble in Little China. Then he pops up with the same exact almost gang in Escape from L.A. and gets killed in that, too.
I love the
John Carpenter reunions. Oh, my gosh. This is almost as good as the Pauly Shore cinematic universe. Because, you know, in Encino Man or California Man, Pauly Shore meets Link, Brendan Fraser. Then next film, Son-in-Law, Link is at Pauly Shore's college, but Pauly Shore doesn't act like he doesn't know him. And then in what's in the army now, Link is in the army and the character there sees him and he doesn't pretend to know him either. So that means Pauly Shore either has like identical triplets or he's a clone because he doesn't know who Link is in those two other movies.
That's right.
And Link must be weirded out because he's like, there's three weasels here. Like, why is three weasels running around? Some odd cinematic universes, I'm telling you.
Completely. Now, I mean, I was looking through his filmography, and I just remembered another great death scene that he has from Beverly Hills Cop 3. You know, where he's one of the mechanics at the beginning, who gets shot. And if I remember correctly, he's the guy who, when he gets shot, you know, like he's just like dancing around when he gets shot, like reverberating with all the bullets. And I believe he's the one who gets the pink gun, you know, landing on his face. And continue, you know, like a red paint that just like, you know, looks like it's blood oozing out of him.
Ooh.
Yeah, there's one of them. I'm pretty sure it's him.
Yeah, I mean, he goes down to Beverly Hills Cop 3. That's on the East Coast, right? That's what, because
that happened in Detroit. That scene happened in Detroit.
I guess that's not the East Coast. Like Midwest. In the North. And then, Midwest. And then that's the catalyst, which takes him west again. For another movie. But yeah, I mean, so he's been killed by Dolph Lundgren. He's been killed by Mel Gibson.
Bruce Willis.
Brandon Lee. Dolph Lundgren. Michael Douglas. Bruce Willis. It's a pretty... like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, that...
Taeyeon Fat, who's a legend. Godzilla kills him. That's impressive.
Also, Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh, yeah, Keith Sutherland.
I'm pretty sure he's the one who kills him in 24.
And then he gets found in Deadwood by Timothy Oliphant. I'll be a dead character who gets found by Timothy Oliphant. That's cool with me. I'm fine with that. But what a great henchman, right? That's why this movie works. One of the reasons why this movie works is you know the henchmen. There's so many movies that come out where the henchmen are so blah. There's only a few that I love Bob and Batman, but that's only because the Joker shoots him. Hey, get your gun. But he's like, there's so few henchmen that I love, and I feel like Die Hard just has. Okay, now that we're almost done, you have one henchman left, but I would dare to say that Die Hard might have the deepest bench of pound for pound memorable henchmen.
I would agree with you on that one.
I mean,
I'm a little biased because I know the names of all 13, terrorists. Yeah. Most people don't, but I know how to differentiate between all of them. Even though some of their names are very similar, Franco and Marco and stuff like that, but I could have done a doctorate on it after all these hours that I've talked about this movie, over the last few months.
Have you ever watched Blind Fury with Rutger Hauer?
Sure.
There's some good henchman work in that. Yeah. Because there's pairs of henchmen, and there's three pairs of henchmen that I can think of that are all visually distinctive. That's what I kind of like.
Yeah, but it's still not as good as the henchmen here.
No, but I would say that if you're going to go for like if you're like teaching a class, movie Rob, you're brought in and you're kind of like, this is how you do a good hench person. Let's say you could use clips from Blind Fury, Die Hard.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's interesting that you said, hench person, because in the original novel, some of the terrorists are women. In the movie, they decided to make them all men.
Yeah. Why not? This is like a sophisticated European group of terrorists. Why couldn't there be you figured Gruber would want a woman come with.
That's right. He'd have like some sort of, Nazi woman there with them. I recently rewatched Passenger 57. You have they bring Elizabeth Hurley on.
Oh yeah,
to have the token female. Or when we eventually get to Die Hard 4, you have the whole thing with Maggie Q. And Die Hard 3, Die Hard with a Vengeance. Solid. You have Katya, played by Sam Phillips, who
she's so good.
Hopefully in a few seasons from now we'll be talking about her and her work and stuff like that.
I was just thinking about this today, and we still have more to talk about with this chapter, but I watched Die Hard 2 and Die Hard before I watched Die Hard with a Vengeance. But like with GoldenEye, I feel like Die Hard with a Vengeance is sort of my Die Hard, because GoldenEye I watched when I was 13, and I was just blown away by Brosnan, Zini on the top, like, I'm invincible, like Sean Bean. Mm-hmm. Die Hard with a Vengeance, I feel like I was at that 13-year-old age, and I went to go see it in the theater by myself, and watching Sam Jackson and Bruce Willis and Jeremy Irons and Katya and the music and the decapitations and the insane exploding helicopter. I know this is random, but I feel like that's my Die Hard, because that's when I was like really into action films around 13.
Okay, that makes sense. It's kind of odd.
Like Die Hard's better. Like there's no argument there, but for some reason it's like Die Hard with a Vengeance is my Die Hard.
Right. I think Die Hard is better because it's enclosed within a building. And in Die Hard 2 and then with a Vengeance and 4 and 5, they try to expand, the area where where all the action is going on, and it each time it takes a little bit away from it because you don't have the intense idea that here it's in one building. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that type of thing. Even Die Hard 2, they stay on a plane, but it's in the airport, and sometimes they're out of the airport, and sometimes he's driving around the neighborhood, trying to find the church, and obviously Die Hard with a Vengeance, mm-hmm. it's all around New York. So yeah, but I think that's why this one works the best. I like watching movies or TV shows that all take place in one room. Or like one enclosed area. That was one of the things I used to love about the original Quantum Leap. Sometimes they had episodes where there was one where they were on this like private plane, and the entire episode took place on the plane. In this little private plane, so you don't have very far to go, and stuff like that. It gives you a lot more information about the characters that way. So maybe that's why
bottle episodes can be good, right? Have you watched Community at all?
No.
Sometimes when they had to do a cheap episode, they would just be in detention or study hall. Mm-hmm. They would just be the characters in one room,
right,
or playing Dungeons and Dragons. That's a great character development.
Yeah.
And I think too, like I also love the movies Dread and The Raid. Like, I think The Raid is my favorite action film of the 21st century, probably with 13 Assassins and The Raid 2. Those are probably my favorite.
Okay, well, but kind of the Dread same, and The Raid are the same movie, you know. It's just different costumes.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah.
It's the same plot. It's the exact same plot.
Yes and no. I mean, yes and no. But it's still like, I mean, I just love those. So it's got to be something, you know, Under Siege is that, just horizontal. But I still love it. So I guess.
No, but Under Siege, the problem with Under Siege is you can't really visualize where they are the entire time. You know, they're jumping around the ship, going to different places and stuff like that. Here, you know more or less what floor he's on, where he is, you know, where he's going, where the action is taking place, you know, where the vault is, where, you know what floor things are happening on. With Under Siege, I mean, it's great. It happens to be one of my favorite. It's my favorite Steven Seagal film, because I'm not much of a Steven Seagal fan, but I just love the way that Under Siege works. But you never get the idea that you know where everything is going on. You know, and if you want to compare it to something else at sea. So think about Titanic.
Well,
Titanic,
I was talking about sort of single locations where I just love them. Like,
right.
If there's an adventure movie, I love it. If there's like a single location movie, I'm like, yeah, it's cool. I'll watch it. I like it. Cube. Like, they're in a cube the whole time.
Right.
Like, for some reason, that draws me in and I dig it. So, right. I mean, okay. I the geography probably is not as clear as Die Hard, but what you're saying is just like, Die Hard keeps it so singular and you know where everything is. But I also think, I don't know what you think about this, but like comparing movies to Die Hard is something that I've just stopped doing. Comparing movies to Jurassic Park is something. Yeah. It's like, you know, I think there's only been a couple 100-point games ever in the NBA. Right. And so like, I just think if a player goes and has a 100-point game, which let's call that Die Hard, and then they go have like a 60-point game, no one's going to be like, oh, that game sucked. It wasn't as good as his 100-point game. Like, I think everyone's going to know that like 100-point game is such an outlier. So with Die Hard and Jurassic Park and those movies, like when people talk about the sequels, they're like, it doesn't reach the heights of the original. It's like, yeah, but like nothing does.
Correct.
So it's such a weird thing where like the second Jurassic Park is fun, but they're like, it's not as good as the first one. And I'm like, what is? I don't know. Sorry, that's my
no.
You hear that a lot with.
I agree.
You hear that a lot with criticism, and it's just like, it's like you can't always like a dude bowls a 300 game, and then.
Well, I don't know. If bowling is the rest. Is the greatest example, because a 300, you can't get beyond a 300 game. You know, someone can theoretically make
a. You told me no with Under Siege. You told me no with bowling. I'm trying to make a point. like the bowling, a 300 game is good. A 300 game is the best, right?
Yeah.
But if you go and you bowl a 250 game, people aren't going to be like, oh, that was a bad game.
Correct.
Like that's like they're not going to be like, it wasn't as good as Hank's, because everyone knows that like a 300 game is the best you can do. So like a 250 game is great. And so like I think like in comparison, most movies when people compare movies to classics, like people compare Deep Blue Sea to Jaws. And it's like it's no Jaws. And you're like, wait. Like what? Like what? Deep Blue Sea isn't Jaws, so it just bothers me. So when people talk about like Die Hard movies and they're like, "Well, it's not as good as Die Hard," it just bothers me. That's my tangent. It's like, guys, stop comparing movies to like the classic. Has Al Young ever been killed by a bowling ball?
I have no idea, absolutely no idea. But let's go back to Die Hard. We'll talk about Al Young. So Al Young, Uli runs down the stairs, the flight of stairs, after he's herded everybody onto the. Onto the roof, and as he's walking down he opens the door, and this is a great cut because we see from above, you know, that he's going down the stairs, and then he reaches out to open the door, and then the shot changes, and then we see him opening, you see the door opening in front of us, so we see his face as he's getting there, and the look of shock on his face is just great. He like jumps back for a second. He's like, you know, like he didn't expect this at all. And then the next thing we get another shot of him from behind. And, you know, we see him looking into the door. And then we see, you know, like these, we hear four shots and we see these squibs just go all over the place. There's so much blood from those four shots that John makes right there. You know, great, great squib work from that, from that perspective.
Oh, wonderful squib work. I don't even know how they, I mean, that's really, yeah, that's really good work. And also he doesn't say freeze and walks him up. Like he just shoots him. He's John McClane does not play. He murders this guy.
Well, because he saw what happened.
Talked about why John McClane is, why is John McClane tan? He's a New York cop. Does he go to the beach a lot?
Wait, is that tan or is that grime?
I mean, early on when he has his shirt off, he's quite tan. Like when he has his when he has his tank top on.
Okay.
Why is he so tan?
I don't know.
Does John McClane sunbathe?
You would think he doesn't have time because he's, you know, got a backload of scumbags that he's trying to get put away. So I don't know.
So why is he so tan?
That is a great question, Mark. And do you have an answer? Do you have a suggestion? No,
that's what I'm asking you.
I have no suggestion. I've never thought about it, but you're right. He does look tanned.
And I'm looking at pictures of him before he gets dirty. You know, he has a little paleness, but no, like, yeah, he's pretty tanned.
Uli just falls backwards and then John moves forward, and I love the way we see that he like reaches down for something, and then we get the overhead shot again, and we see, you know, Uli just lying dead on the staircase, and John has picked up his MP5, you know, as he himself runs up those stairs, you know, trying to find Holly, and then he looks around, he passes all of the various hostages, he passes through them. Now, what I like is that you can recognize some of these hostages from other scenes. You know, none of them have names or anything like that. Like the first woman that he passes has this like red blouse on, and she's the woman who screamed when the elevator opened and we saw, you know, Tony dead. You know, so
wow.
They do a nice job. I mean, some of the others you can't recognize at all. You know. But it, you know, the fact that there are a few that you can recognize, you know, still works. And he starts running through the crowd and he goes, "Where's Holly? Where's Holly Gennaro? Holly Gennaro, where's Holly? Where's Holly? Where is she?" You know, and he like makes his way towards Ginny. You know, he's asking everybody, and basically nobody has any idea what he's talking about. And then he finally finds Ginny. You know, who's still very pregnant. I'm surprised she hasn't gone into labor from all the shock of everything that's been going on over the last few hours.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then he finally...
Gruber could have delivered it.
That's right. He finally found somebody he can talk to. And he asks her, where's... And she goes, "They took her." "Where?" "The vault." "Where's the vault?" "The 30th floor, up the stairs. They just took her." Now... my first question is how does she know? You know, Hans grabbed Holly, and then that was at the point where everybody was getting up to go upstairs.
Yeah.
So Ginny was paying attention to what's going on. And even if Hans had grabbed her, why would, you know, let's say that Hans was keeping her, you know, in the office or whatever it is. You know, why would Ginny even think that they took him to the vault, except for the fact that that's needed to move the plot along?
Didn't he get a message on the walkie to go there?
Nope.
And then he did?
Nope. No message. No message whatsoever. You know,
maybe she just has Sherlock deducing abilities.
It could
be. Listen, criminals are here. Maybe she knows about what's in the vault. Like, they're not there to steal the tchotchkes. They're not there to steal the Muzak CDs.
Right. Maybe, hey, maybe bars. She's the inside man.
Oh my gosh. Wait, then why would she take him to the, why would she send him to the vault?
Because they've already screwed her. They sent her to the roof where they're going to blow it up.
Oh, so she's getting revenge on them.
Maybe. I don't know. And I love the way that she describes where he needs to go. It's as if she works like at a information booth. You know, like, you know, there are places where, you know, you go and you know, where they can give you directions for, you know, I don't know, in a hospital or something like that. And they go, okay, now you go straight. And then you'll get to a corner where you got to make a right, and then you make a left, and another right, and a second right, and a third right, and then you make a left, and then you get to the department that you're looking for and stuff like that. You know, because she says, you know, the 30th floor up the stairs. You know, she sort of sounds like she's giving instruction that she's well-versed as to, you know, how to explain to people how to get to the vault. Maybe that's part of her job.
I mean, this is 88.
Yes.
Because remember back in the day, where do you live? All right, well, you go down 19, you take a left on Pasco Drive. You go down eight blocks, and then you'll see, like, Spring Avenue. You take a right on Spring Avenue. You'll go past the lake, and on your left, there'll be Johnson. You take a left on Johnson. I'm the third house on the left.
Right.
Like, that's what you used to do back in the day. So this is 88.
That's right.
Is what everybody does.
That's right.
Like, everyone just knows, like, because you can't just be, like, put it on your phone. That's like, right. People had to know how to get to your place.
Yeah.
So when they gave out directions, it was just like left, right, straight, 30 miles over that creek. You'll see a dead moose. Take a right.
Yeah. No, it's you remind me of one of the constant arguments that my wife and I have with our 18-year-old son, you know, when he's driving somewhere and we're like, do you know how to get there? And he's like, oh, I'll just put it in my phone and it'll tell me where to go. And like, but do you know how to get there? What if your phone doesn't work? He says, well, then I'll use the person who's in the car next to me, their phone. You know, it's like... It's like he doesn't know if he's going north, south, east, west. It doesn't really make a difference.
Yeah. You know, I guess you just don't need it. Like, I would have loved to have a phone. But I also think, you know, I drove around in cars in Atlanta. I drove a lot of box trucks through downtown Atlanta. I drove a lot of cars because I worked on almost different sets every day. Sometimes, you know, you're at the same studio for a couple months at a time, but then you're back on the road. So every time I use my GPS, I couldn't have driven back there on my own. Like, you don't really know where you're going. I drove around downtown Atlanta for a few years, and I still didn't quite know all the turns because I just relied on GPS.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm happy to have it. Listen, I'm happy. Like, give me GPS.
Yeah, for sure. No, I am.
Nice to know where you're going.
don't think that I'm against it, but you need to have the additional knowledge also. That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Well, I just think GPS prevents – like, I don't need to learn how to go there on my own. So then when your phone goes down, I feel like sometimes you're like completely lost. It reminds me of that SNL sketch when the teleprompter goes down and everyone starts killing each other. I feel like that's what happened when GPS went down. People are like, where am I? Like, just look at the signs. Road signs, what?
Okay. Yeah. I definitely understand that. And then
so I think directions were good.
Okay. And then the shot changes and we see the helicopters approaching again. And John looks up and he sees them. And he starts screaming to people, get downstairs, all of you. The whole roof is wired to blow. Get down. You know, and he starts screaming like again. And goes, get down. Get the downstairs. And people start screaming. I love how we see some of the hostages. They point towards the Hueys. Hey, here's our ride. You know, that type of thing. You know, I'm waiting to see one of them, you know, pull out a thumb. That they're, you know, like thumbing a ride. And, you know.
It's a tough situation for him, right? Because you can't just be logical with people because the roof could blow at any moment.
Correct.
So you can't just be like, all right, guys, so here's what happened. There's a gang of international robbers. We got to go down because it's going to blow. You just got to get them downstairs by any means. So, yeah, he actually puts himself in danger by shooting that gun in the air. But that's what he has to do.
Yeah.
Like, move people. He doesn't have time to chat with 30 scared people.
Right. And it works. While looking his hand. As soon as he starts shooting – They just, you know, he's just screaming. I love you see the there's a guy with a mustache, this blonde guy with a mustache. I always remember him in this because this is the only time that you see him as one of the hostages, and he gets to like scream in terror, you know, because John's shooting, you know, that type of thing.
Great blonde hair, lovely blonde hair, by the way.
Yeah,
that's a good extra yell.
It could be.
I'd like to be an extra on this scene. Mark Extra could be in this.
Yeah, it could be, but you know, you got prick extra, you got prick mark here, so you know.
Yeah, prick mark. Ow!
Exactly.
Funny scene. I love that moment. Oh gosh.
And then we get another shot inside the Huey, and then we see the pilot, you know, scream. Again, I don't know how they hear each other because he's obviously screaming into the microphone, but they make it look as if he's talking to him directly. And he goes, they made us, Bureau. You got a terrorist shooting hostages. And then our good friend Johnson goes, I see it. Bank left. You know, he's once again, overconfident, you know, cocky, knows what he's got to do. And, you know, is completely sure of himself of what's going to happen here. And then
he just wants to murder people.
Yeah. Then we get another shot from the viewpoint of the helicopter as it's approaching once again Nakatomi. And another great shot because you can actually see all the people, including John McClane standing on the helipad, you know, as the helicopter begins its approach towards them, stuff like that. And that's actually how the minute ends. Mm. Now, wouldn't John be a little concerned when he's shooting in the air that he's going to hit the Huey?
No, he's that good.
Okay, that's fair.
I mean, the shells might, the bullets might, you know, shoot into earth and then fall onto something, which they'll have to, because the bullets have to come down.
Yeah.
So he can maybe shoot the Huey later.
Right. But again, he doesn't want to shoot the Huey. It's like the same idea that when we were talking about months ago, you know, that he didn't shoot at Al because he has no reason to shoot at them, because he's still a good guy. He wants, you know, he has no plans of killing any of the good guys or even wounding them.
Mm-mm. I mean, he's not going to shoot the Huey. He knows it. He's fine. He's John McClane.
Yeah, but he doesn't think, I mean, well, we'll see starting next week, you know, when the Huey starts shooting back. He wasn't really expecting that either. You know, he is shooting at them, but he doesn't expect they're going to shoot back.
Yeah, but I mean, these are all, is it a smart idea to shoot in the air when a Huey's coming close to you that's presumably armed? No. But how do you get those people off the roof?
Right. Well, especially since they're not listening.
Like in this situation, I feel like in this situation, it is it's a act and then deal with whatever comes from that action.
Right.
Okay. Because he has to get the people off the roof first. And then it's like, all right, how do I get them off the roof the fastest? I'll do this. All right, now what do I have to deal with? Oh, Huey's shooting at me. Okay, what do I do next?
Right.
I got to jump off this building with this thing. Oh, wait, I didn't untie it. Like, that's his – he can't – like, I think he just has to keep, you know, like, taking a – when it goes down a cliff, it forms like a – when you put a thing of a snowball down a thing, it just becomes bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So it just keeps snowballing for him, but he has no time to think. So it's like, I'll deal with it later type thing. Okay. That's what I
say. All right, that's fair. That's fair. So, Mark, you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the few little script differences?
I just I'm glad to be a guest. I got 5 really good minutes. I love these moments. I got to talk about Al Young. Like, what a great time. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're not done yet. Not done yet.
Yeah.
So the script, as I always talk about, I love the fact that the script is very descriptive of everything that's going on. So it starts off, it says, exterior of the roof, the door rattles, his back to the camera. Uli goes to the door, opens it, and 2 bullets come out of his back. Smoking Beretta in hand, McClane vaults over the body before it has even stopped twitching. As the hostages squeal and scream, McClane snatches up Uli's machine gun, runs out onto the roof. He charges through the crowd, spots Ginny near the edge of the roof. She meets him halfway. And then they have the whole conversation, where's Holly, and things like that. And then Ginny says they took her after they saw the kids on television. And then John goes, what? God. And then he sees the helicopters getting closer. He tells everyone they have to get down. He goes, listen to me, all of you, get down to the lower floors. You're all in danger. One of the hostages screams at him, what are you, crazy? We're being rescued. Those helicopters, and McClane screams, there won't be for those helicopters to land on because the whole top of this building is wired with explosives. Now get below. Another hostage says, but we're safe up here. McClane says, safe my ass. This ain't a helipad. It's a launching pad. And he fires over their heads. They scream, head for the doors, as he hoped. He fires again, raking a line across the roof. They really begin to haul ass. McClane, get below, now! And then it says, a young FBI agent is in the helicopter with a rifle and a partner. The young FBI goes into the microphone, looking out the door. Flight leader, this is Wing. I think they're onto us. One of the terrorists is firing on the hostages. So, it's always fun to read what's in the script, but the final version is just so much better. You know, we don't have to have John arguing with the hostages or having them argue with him. You know, it's just not needed. The one thing I would have kept is the fact that Ginny said after they saw the kids on TV, because this way John then knows that happened. Because later on when Holly, you know, decks Thornburg, he doesn't really understand why. You know,
he just wanted to trust her.
Yeah. Well, obviously he's going to trust her. You know, that's what she's there for. You got to trust Holly.
That's funny. Yeah, because he doesn't. But then I guess that would, if she goes, the TV report, what TV report?
Exactly. Like, that's true.
Yeah. So, I mean,
There's no way of saying that distinctly.
Get rid of all that.
Right. There's no way of saying that distinctly.
Get rid of all of it. Yeah, absolutely. No way of saying that succinctly.
Yeah.
It's tough. No way of saying that succinctly. But yeah, it's, I think they pared it down really well. I mean, listen, I get why you had two people arguing, but you just got to trim all that. Like, he's dealt with enough crowds.
Yeah.
Yeah. He knows what's up.
All right. So every Friday we have a segment called Weekend Surprise, where my guest has to answer a question related to Die Hard. Okay. And, ooh, you know, any 34 years since Die Hard came out, there has been one major controversy about the movie that is still unsettled. And that is Die Hard a Christmas movie or not? And people have different opinions. So what do you think, Mark? Is Die Hard a Christmas movie or isn't it? And explain your answer.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And
why?
I had to do a Lethal Weapon versus Die Hard episode for Rotten Tomatoes. And so I got to run here just a second. I did like which one's the better kind of Christmas action film. And so I pulled up I found a list here where they're like, how many times does Christmas mention in Die Hard? So at the airport, in the limo, in the floor main lobby, in the parking garage, at the gas station, at the Nakatomi Plaza, in the credits. Then you have how many props? You have the airplane, the teddy bear Christmas gift. You have floor 30 Holly's office. There's like a bunch of Christmas stuff. You have the elevator with the Santa hat. You have floor 30 vault Christmas tape, like the bell, the gift, the sky, like the paper falling from like the buildings resemble snow. In the script, you have Wish You a Merry Christmas, Harriet's Christmas Eve, Family, Stockings, Chestnuts, Rudolph and Frosty, Ebenezer Scrooge, Looking for Presents, Santa and Mommy, Christmas Music, Hey, Merry Christmas, Christmas in Japan, this time, like, there's so many different times. Like, it's Christmas Eve, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, Argyle. Like, there's so many mentions of it. And then, like, set decoration, there's Christmas trees, there's sleighs, there's reindeers, there's Santa Claus, there's lights, there's more Santa Claus, there's blue Christmas garland, there's snowflakes on snowflake Christmas lights, there's poinsettias, there's Christmas ribbons, there's Christmas graffiti, there's Christmas wreaths. Like, there's so many different references to Christmas in this film. I don't know why people say it's not. Now, if this took place in Minnesota, Minneapolis, right, on a skyscraper, in the snow, with all the Christmas decorations, the same music, people would be like, yeah, it's a Christmas movie, yeah, because it's like snowy and this. But this is Los Angeles during Christmas. Like, I grew up in Florida during Christmas. It didn't feel like Christmas. But when it was still December 25th, it was Christmas. So I think people who say it's not – like, well, it's not Christmas themed. Like, but I don't, this is a Christmas movie. Like, this movie takes place on Christmas. And there are so many references to Christmas. So it's such a weird argument. Like, it takes place during Christmas and there's tons of Christmases, but it's not about like getting your soul back. It's not It's a Wonderful Life. It's not Miracle on 34th Street. It's not Holiday Inn. It's not White Christmas. There's no Santa Claus. But then, you know, you look at Love Actually. You look at, let's see, what else? Reindeer Games. You look at these movies Good that example. Take place around this time, and I just think you really like, it's like the horror genre. It's so expansive. So people are like, oh, this movie's not a horror movie. It's a dark psychological fairy tale. It's like, yeah, but if it was a blockbuster, it would be under the horror genre.
Right.
So it's really hard to say it's not because of just the amount of examples of sound and music, props in the script, and set decoration. Like, you can't. Like, it is. It's a Christmas movie.
Okay.
It's absolutely a Christmas movie.
All right. And, so yeah, that's fine. And think about what John's wife's name is.
Holly. yeah, I even missed that. Jeez Louise. But yeah, it's like what do you need Santa in the sky going, "Whoa!" You know, it's Florida Christmas, like Ernest Saves Christmas. That's in Orlando. It has a different vibe. Like, it's, I'm telling you, like, if this took place in Minneapolis, people would be like, yeah, Christmas movie. But this is a Christmas movie. This is a movie that takes place on Christmas, Christmas Eve. There's tons of references to it, a lot of music. It's just not the traditional, like, you know, people could say it's not the traditional Christmas movie, but it's still a Christmas movie.
All right.
That's my breakdown.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Mark. So, Mark, do you want to tell people how they can find Mark Hoffmeyer?
Just look up on the top of the nearest skyscraper next to you recording this episode. No, Movies, Films, and Flicks. Movies, Films, and FLIX. Quick shout out. The cool website Audible, who the Amazon company with all the audiobooks, just put us on our list of the best movie podcast you need to listen to in 2022, and Audible's huge, so that's pretty cool. And then that was a good shout out. Really happy about that. And then, yeah, Movies, Films, and Flicks. You can listen to Con Air, the podcast, Deep Blue Sea. I also work for Fandom, Rotten Tomatoes, and The Film Theorist. So just type in Mark Hoffmeyer and all those things.
All right. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on Podcatcher, my views, and listen to this show. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. Or you can go directly to my website, movierobminute.com. So, Mark, thank you very much. This has been such a fun week. You know, we're almost at the end of the movie. We only have another 17 episodes to go, 17 minutes left of the movie. But we'll get there. We'll get there. And hopefully you'll be back for season four when I announce what season four is. Hopefully you'll be interested in coming back. So
the 13th Warrior, for your 13th season, what movie with 13 in the title are you going to do?
I'm not doing them according to the numbers, you know. Because, you know, this is the third season, so then it should have been Die Hard 3 from that perspective. You know, I need to have something with a 3 in it, but I didn't.
This mess with people, though.
There are three letters in the word die. There you go.
Man, yeah, perfect. I like that. That makes sense. Yeah. That works.
All right. Well, everyone have a great weekend, and I'll be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!